ます。 headphones on. It looks like you've got your own music to listen to. I'm just here for the walk.
Thank you. Say a few words about psychogeography, which is a motivating spirit in some sense behind the series of concerts we've been performing in Scotland. Lately, psychogeography has become a code word for something like keen observation and unburied histories, especially of feminist or labor or gender. And I think it's terrific. I think the kind of stuff that is being done under that aegis is valuable and useful. But I want to suggest that psychogeography used to be something a little different from what it's turned into, and that what it used to be has something useful to suggest about what it could be. I think it could be a lot more than it is, or a lot more useful than it is. Psychogeography was coined as a word in any of its current senses in the early 50s by Guy Debord, who at the time was a letterist. Letterists were a fragment of the Parisian avant-garde following World War II, that emerged following World War II, and that somehow worked themselves out of dissolving surrealism. Guy Debord was extremely interested from the very beginning relationship between people and their environment. And I think that it's not too much to say that he was enraged by what was happening to the Paris that he loved. And I should say that it was happening particularly to the Paris that he loved. The Paris that he didn't love he didn't really care that much about, but coincidentally, it wasn't the Paris that anything much was happening to. The sort of thing that got him can be exemplified just by looking at the space right outside behind you. In fact, he uses an illustration of a space very, very similar to this in one of his early publications to suggest the kind of horror that was occurring in the city that he had found, at least in places, to be essentially human. This wasn't. Whatever's going on in the space that we're in now, as interesting as it may be at the moment, is frankly a mark of such design irresponsibility, it's almost hard to talk about it. And in his anger, he started thinking about a way that we could objectify the sorts of things that he liked about Paris and the sorts of things about Paris that he responded to really strongly, that he sort of caught together under the term unities of ambience. These unities of ambience were places that were powerfully attractive. They were imbued with this powerful, attractive force that would literally pull you into them if you let yourself be pulled into them, if you didn't force yourself to go off in some other kind of agenda. And to discover these spaces, you had to do a couple of things. And these he wrapped together under the name drift, or dérive, which has become a very popular sort of pastime today. But for him, was anything but a pastime. It was an extremely serious activity. The drift was a way of letting yourself go. You literally approached the city with no agenda and no intention whatsoever, which is a lot harder to do than it sounds, which was one of the problems right off the bat. And in this condition of agendalessness, when you started walking, the parts of the city that were powerfully attractive would pull you into them, and the parts of the city that were repulsive would push you away. And so all you had to do was let yourself go and just move, and the city would naturally pull you across this terrain of passion that he was able to identify and ultimately map. Another thing that was important to him was that this be an objective measure. He wasn't really interested in subjectivities of any kind. And to make sure it was objective, he insisted you had to drift in groups. Not huge groups. This would be way, way, way too big to drift. But 3, 4, 5, maybe as many as 10 people, sort of like-minded people, and you would meet and you would vacate yourself of agendas and intentions, and you just drift. And because you were doing it together, the synchrony among you as you moved or pulled through these spaces would guarantee the objectivity of the outcome. He mapped these, a couple of very famous and increasingly influential maps. Discourse of the Passion of Love he did in 56, and in 57 with Asker Jorn he did another map, The Naked City. And these maps consist of fragments of ordinary street maps. And these fragments are these unities of ambience. And he's put them down on paper, he's connected them with red arrows. The red arrows represent the force that pulls you or pushes you from place to place. And you can, there's some places that act like turntables where you enter them and you don't have to just be pulled off in one direction, you have the possibility of being pulled off in several. And so literally this is a map of the Paris that's desirable, a desire map of Paris as it were. This effort, in fact, the whole situationist effort, because by the time he started doing these maps, he'd become a situationist, or he transformed his leftist international into a situationist international. This was a fragmentary effort. This was a fugitive effort. There were never a lot of situationists, even if you count the situationists in all the different parts of the world where there were situationists. Probably, 100? There's an online catalog that you can go to, and you can see everybody who would be identified as situationist, and the most capacious I've seen has 250 people. And that's really, they were handfuls of them. And after 68, May 68, they were extremely involved in Paris in May 68. There were 70 situations in the world. I must never say situations. It was with situations. The Situationist International dissolved and came to a conclusion. And that was that. Everybody forgot about it. Until the 90s. And in the 90s, thanks to translations and the growing importance of his book, The Society of the Spectacle, Guy Debord's work began to be recovered and became increasingly influential and today is responsible for lots and lots and lots of people all over the world going on drifts all the time. Okay, that's one important moment that I want to talk about, an early moment in the history of psychogeography. Another materialized in Massachusetts in the same time that De Boer was engaged in the same activities, was brought into being by a planner, an MIT planner named Kevin Lynch. He was a professional academic at an engineering school, and it was about as far removed from a situationist ethos as you could possibly imagine. And yet he too was dismayed by what planning in the 50s was doing to the city that he loved, in this case Boston, and he became concerned to figure out how he could do something about it. And he didn't do the same thing, but he did something somewhat similar. He was really concerned to understand how ordinary people perceived and moved about there in their cities. And he didn't drift as an academic. He went out with questionnaires and asked people questions and had them draw sketch maps and took them on walking tours and recorded their descriptions of their trip. In fact, those might be the first recordings. They were done in the late 50s. The first recordings of people's descriptions of just moving through the city and their responses to them. He produced in 1960 a book, The Image of the City, which came along with maps. Maps as erratic in their power as Guy Debord's, and a lot more widely known. The Image of the City, which is the book, has been in continuous print since 1960. That's quite a run for an academic book that one would imagine on the face of it would be read by relatively small numbers of people. A lot of people thought all of a sudden that utilizing these Lynchian techniques was somehow like we could just slice your head open and look down and see the map of your city in your head. And people went out in large numbers and carried out Lynchian type work. Mostly carried out by his students, but he had a large number of students and they occupied important positions in planning departments, not only in the United States but elsewhere in the world. It's another psychogeography that came into being when David Stay, who was strongly influenced by Kevin Lynch, who was a psychologist, came to Clark University as a member of the geography department and taught a course originally in human environment interactions that soon became called by students and was then officially called psychogeography. And Stay in psychogeography, which basically consumed Lynch's work and tried to expand it, was the foundation for a 5, maybe 7 year run of psychogeography among geographers. A lot of work was done at this time. David Stay and I wrote a cognitive atlas, psychological explorations of 4 Mexican cities, for example. And David Stay was supplemented by another psychologist on the geography faculty, Robert Shane Beck, with whom I wrote a book called Home Rules. Many other really important works in what would become environmental psychology were produced at this time. And in fact, these people would go on and found or head environmental psychology programs elsewhere in the United States. Again, psychogeography as such sort of withered and disappeared. Not to return in any important way until with the rediscovery of Debordian psychogeography, psychogeography became current again. And once again, there's a growing interest in the work of the psychogeographers in eastern Massachusetts in the 60s and the early 70s. I think what's really critical about both of these psychogeographies is that they wanted to use people to measure the environment. They didn't want to use maps, they didn't want to use tape measures, they didn't want to use clocks, they didn't want to use timers. They wanted to use people. And on that note, we're going to go on to our next site, where I'll have a few other things to say about shadowed spaces.
Thank you. Where are you taking us, Brian? Of course I do, Briny. Take the shortcut. You've been spending too much time around these parts.
Possibly. How's the recording working out?
Oh, hardly even notice it's there. Have you been to the old soup kitchen?
Yeah, we were going to take everybody past it, but right. I was worried that certain people wouldn't get down the... There's a little bit that's about that wide.
Right, yeah.
Really worried that this wouldn't fit. Why don't you just run off in the wrong direction? Okay. Yeah. Can I ask you a favour? Can you lead people vaguely back to where we started?
Yep.
And then down the thing straight ahead, going up to, see that building there?
So, under the underpass?
No, we can just go straight across.
Alright, okay.
And then, along there. Do you know what I mean?
No.
Do you see where it goes from between pink and yellow?
Yep.
We're heading in there.
Yeah, okay.
And I'll catch you there.
Alright. I said, your tour is rubbish. I've been on better ghost tours in Edinburgh. What's that?
I'm glad the wee Scottish bastard like you was recorded safe. So
I'm quite enjoying my rudeness with fellow Scotsmen down south. It's quite nice. Well, I work with Simon McCall most days.
Yeah, he's got us. I've never heard him speak.
Have you not?
I've
you not know him?
Seen him kind of vague. I didn't actually know he spoke, actually.
Yeah, he does. He does. We usually gang up in Kamal together. I was thinking for a laugh to just take them all into the bar.
Yeah.
Only in the office.
Oh.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, obviously. I don't actually like him.
Mate.
Aye, it's no bad. Have you done any of these in the pissing rain?
No.
You've been lucky.
Yeah, really spawny.
Cool.
So far.
That's great. We're doing a performance work with Lone Twin just now.
Alright.
And they came up a couple of weeks ago to do research, and the first day they went out to talk to people, 4-hour slot, but it was a couple of assistants. I just pissed it down outside.
Really?
I was like, ah, okay.
And they're just speaking to people in the street?
Having conversations with people in the street.
Right.
Okay.
Well, maybe we need to slow down a little bit. Some guy really pecking at that there.
Suddenly quite nervous about this, Barry.
You what?
I'm suddenly quite nervous about this.
No, I just don't want to feel over.
Where does this go after this? Not the walk.
This is the last spot.
But you do it and not the walk, so the whole thing?
Right, the whole thing. Cumbernauld.
What's it called?
Ronnie Corbett was busy, unfortunately. yeah, we've got three really amazing sites in Cumbernauld, and then something in Edinburgh. We have to transport people, the whole audience, across town in taxis.
Really?
Great. It's going to be great. They've all got the taxis, they've all got random instructions, so they're paid a flat fee and they're told to scatter and rearrange themselves.
Cool.
Out of sight.
And are you getting backing from a taxi company to do it?
Oh, what?
Are you getting any backing from a taxi company?
Yeah, just because they think it's funny. Yeah.
Right, okay. There's just, I know I've got this taxi project that I want to do at some point that's a taxi confessional. But we just kind of really need to get a taxi company on board.
All
so
right.
You get in the taxi and as you go, you...
All right, do you know Jeff Perkins?
No.
Fluxus artist from New York, Brooklyn in the 70s.
Yeah.
He was a cab driver and actually he's got a whole, that's his project.
Is it really?
Yeah,
there's a couple.
Yeah.
I know there's a couple of been done by American artists, but I
right.
don't know them, so I don't know who they are. So. Yeah. What's his name, Jeff?
Jeff Perkins.
Okay.
He's pals with Yoko Ono. You see his, what's it called? Yoko Ono's thing for Fluxbox, you know, where it's that film with people's asses walking down the thing?
Yeah.
That's his ass.
I'll recognise him.
Yeah.
Yeah, I should have a look at it. What's she up to?
So, shadowed spaces. What are the shadowed spaces? Well, we're in one. The shadowed spaces are a whole other story, but they were, of course, something of extreme interest to people like Guy Debord, and ultimately of great interest to people like Kevin Lynch as well, and for just the opposite reason. For Guy Debord, a shadow, what I call the shadowed spaces, which have a slightly different connotation from the sorts of spaces that Debord was particularly interested in, they were about everything that the normative planning world that was destroying this Paris was not about. And they were, in a kind of flagrant way, about desire and about passion. In a complicated way, but in a very flagrant kind of a way. My interest in the shadowed spaces arises as a geographer, physical geographer. The story is actually, I think, in that little brochure that you've got. I was doing an investigation of surface water in Worcester, Massachusetts, scrambling over fences to get to the water, looking at the water, and discovering in places where there should have been no human occupation of any kind, well, discovering, among other things, underpants, which was sort of what got me pushed into this search. What were all these pairs of underpants doing in places like this? And of course, places like this, it's more than underpants. In fact, I don't think in a place like this you'll find many underpants. one of the corollaries is when you find signs of wine drinking in a shadow space, you're not going to find any other kids. That's just a systematic observation. It's proven true over time, hundreds and hundreds of shadowed spaces. And this is very clearly a space that's used for a variety of purposes. But I actually did find a pair of pants, but jeans. You may walk over them. They were here yesterday. I don't know if they're still here. What were these spaces all about? Where were they? What were they used for? How did they come to be? And how did they fit into this second geographic matrix? Clearly, from the board's perspective, these are not people on a drift. You find these. These are people on a quest. And the quest is to find the kind of spaces the board is interested in that are not the spaces that he hates. I don't know. Maybe there are cameras here. I don't see any. I don't know if you noticed the cameras in the site where we started. They were all over the place, and they were all kinds of cameras, and they were attached to all kinds of structures. Each one of those buildings had its own set of cameras on the space, and there were cameras on the bridge as well. Who knows if anybody was watching them, but good Lord, there were eyes on those spaces. Are you pointing to a camera? I thought somebody was pointing to a camera back there. No, these spaces are obviously spaces that lack precisely those kinds of things. And they lack them, it's the lack of those that draws the people here to carry out the kinds of human behaviors that they feel are necessary. One of the things I've always been stressing about the shadow spaces is that when we're talking about these spaces, we're not just talking about spaces that make room for behavior that might be regarded as criminal, certainly regardable as non-normative. It's spaces in which activities take place which you don't believe will stand the light of day, the eyeballing of the normative eye. And those clearly encompass not merely the kinds of things that go on here, but the kind of things that go on in the privacy of your bed, and the kind of things that went on in the early revolutionary fomentations of almost any revolution you care to think about, and that characterized the early behavior of most radical art movements. And you can't stop numbering these things. They take place where people can't see what they're doing. Sometimes they never come out into the light of day, and sometimes they come out in the light of day in a big way, and they change things for people. So these spaces that I'm particularly interested in here are spaces that enable the performance of activities which are essential for us in a wide variety of ways. These perhaps focus those interests in a peculiarly tight way, but nonetheless, these are very, very real things. Clearly, Tomio, for example, the saxophone player, he can't perform that in the most ordinary kind of spaces. It just draws way too much attention, disproprium. We got clapping tonight, but in Aberdeen we got an onion and a potato. These spaces call to people like Tamio. They call to people like Sean Meehan, one of the drummers. And in these spaces they really feel capable of doing what it is that they do. So I'm trying to think about these musicians as examples of humans being used to tell us about spaces. And I guess this is where I think psychogeography in the model described by Debord and the model described by Kevin Lynch can ultimately go. That is, we all can become the kinds of instruments that are going to be useful and valuable in understanding and learning about the spaces that we occupy. We will let ourselves pay attention and feel what we feel. We can actually learn an awful lot about our world. And with that, let's listen to another instrument responding to our environment.
Thank you.
quite like it.
Oh, right. It has a rusty feel.